WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. All right, producers Claire Hyman and Micah Yason are here with me in studio.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey, Sasha.
Welcome, welcome. So today on the show, we're talking about, well, talking, right? Specifically, the art of great conversations. Claire, why were you too interested in this?
I think working on a daily talk show, we're thinking all the time about what makes a good conversation,
true,
right? It's what we do. But this idea kind of came to me because I ride public transit 6 times a week. And sometimes I'm just shocked by how quiet the trains and buses are. I'm like, why aren't we chatting? So I kind of wanted to just talk about how to get conversations going with anyone, whether it's a stranger or someone you're already close with,
yes,
in your life.
That's a great, great point. What about you, Micah?
I think one thing that I noticed as a producer on the show, we have conversations all the time with the guests. You know, we're doing pre-interviews. We're getting to know the people that we're about to have conversations with. And then I turn off that producer, that producer role in my head, and I completely forget to have conversations, like how to have conversations with just normal people in my life. So it just kind of felt like a good time to have a reset.
Yes, I love that. And for me, conversations come pretty easily, just, you know, being host of this show, I think you can sort of pick up on that. But when it comes to having tough conversations, that's when I become just a huge chicken. So, Micah, tell us a little bit about who you all brought on the show for this chat.
Yeah, absolutely. So we invited on Paula Marantz Cohen. She's the author of Talking Cure, an essay on the civilizing power of conversation. And now we wanted to talk to Paula because she wrote a book about the art of conversation. And something she mentioned, too, is that she grew up in a family of talkers.
Yeah.
So it was kind of almost like a memoir as well. And so she just kind of seemed like the perfect person to talk to.
Great.
We also spoke with Danielle Portis, and she's a licensed clinical professional counselor at Rose Gold Crowns. And she was definitely that person that we wanted to lean on when it came to having those tough conversations. She's talking to couples who are, you know, coming to her when they have those points of contention and there's some disagreements, and she helps them navigate that. And we also spoke with Stephanie Boron. She's an assistant clinical professor at Northwestern University. She's a professor, so she every single day is talking to her students as well.
Yeah, that's right. And we actually started by asking Stephanie, what makes a good conversation?
There's a lot to unpack in that, right? And a lot of the work that I do is supporting folks who communicate differently. So this might be autistic folks or otherwise neurodivergent, meaning our brains are just wired differently than the societal definition of normal. We could unpack that for another hour. But I think where I want to begin is at the core of it. It's about connection for me. And I think as humans, we're all wired to want to connect, no matter how our brains work. So for me, it has to do with making space for folks within communication to show up in an authentic way for them, and for figuring out how we can kind of navigate our expectations of communication to make a more accessible space.
Yeah. What about you, Paula? What do you think? What makes a good conversation?
Okay. I come at it from a more personal point of view, and it's very nourishing for me to be able to talk with people, to connect with them, and also to lose myself in a conversation, to feel really free to express what I think and who I am, and listen to the other person in that way. And that is so life affirming. And I think we need more of it.
I want a definition from you, Stephanie, because I'm curious what neurodiversity affirming speech looks like.
Absolutely. It's sort of a newer term in our field, and not a lot of people know about it. So within the world of speech and language pathology, there used to be a focus on teaching folks to show up as what you might expect, mm-hmm. you know, making eye contact and maintaining a topic, having that reciprocity that is more what a neurotypical person might present as. Neurodiversity-affirming speech and language pathologists really help to support that person in being able to advocate for their own needs within communication and conversation, being able to help create more accessible spaces from neurotypical folks mm-hmm. in terms of how they're engaging with and allowing space for autistic folks or folks that communicate in other ways.
Yeah, I love that. I'm curious, Paula, why you wanted to write your book about conversation.
Well, I love it. I'm a teacher also, so I would connect with your other guest here in that when I lead a class and a good class, I want everyone, no matter what their background or their particular makeup, how comfortable they feel with speech, to feel that they can talk and that we can exist as a group. And that's something that really, I've worked on, and I feel a great seminar is one where everyone participates and the teacher is the facilitator and is part of the conversation.
Is having a good conversation about asking a lot of questions, Stephanie? I mean, we had a Reset listener, Erica from Riverwoods, Illinois. She called and she said that the best way to make conversation is to ask questions about other people. What do you think about that?
I always feel like leading with curiosity is so key. And that can take so many forms, right? But I think, you know, when we lead with curiosity, whether it's through asking questions about other people or through getting curious about what they need to be in a space with us and to feel true belonging and community, I think that curiosity is so key.
Mm-hmm. Something else key, listening, right? Because that's very important. Paula, why do you think that some people have such a tough time really listening?
I think they're just so eager to say what they want to say. And it is hard to step back and listen. And but a good conversation is one that builds on what the other person said and isn't simply about waiting to say what you have to say. I think that's a very hard thing for people to do sometimes because they really want to share. But a really good conversation means creating something together with the other person and not simply waiting your turn.
Absolutely. It sounds just like what Stephen Covey says, who's author of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. A lot of us have read that book. But he writes, and I say this all the time in personal conversations, most people don't listen with the intent to understand. They listen with the intent to reply. We got a comment from a Reset newsletter reader, David, about listening. This is what David wrote in. He said, if we all really listen better, we may well understand each other far better. Cliff Notes, and he says, quote, because I'm old, Cliff Notes may have helped one pass a test, but true understanding comes from getting the full context of what we're taking in. If you find yourself waiting for the other person to take a breath just so that you could jump in, at least one of you is probably communicating wrong. Do you agree, Paula?
Absolutely, yes. And, when you listen, you learn something maybe about yourself and about the other person you might not have known. And it takes the conversation in a new direction. I mean, the sense of surprise is so important. I mean, when people are just mouthing what they already think or what they think they think, it's boring. And when you really listen and you are surprised by what the other person says, mm-hmm. It's very creative and wonderful.
You agree, Stephanie?
I think it's so fascinating, this topic of listening, because I think when you get a bunch of people with diverse brains in a space, the way that we're expecting folks to communicate might make it really hard for some folks to feel regulated enough to listen, to feel safe in that space. So I think, as I'm listening to you, Paula, what I'm noticing is the passion in your voice about this topic and finding ways that we can communicate around those like true deep interests and going to that other level. And that helps, me to feel really regulated and able to participate in this conversation as an autistic woman in this space. So I think, being aware of following other people's passions to find that core understanding of where we can come together, and also giving people, giving them grace and trying to create opportunities where we give them the benefit of the doubt that they're doing the best they can.
Let's shift to small talk. The idea of having small talk, I mean, some folks, that drives them insane, right? It sounds like a nightmare. It could be a nightmare. It could also be a great time, though. So I'm curious your tips on making small talk. You first, Stephanie.
Well, I have to giggle at this one a little bit because I do hate small talk. And it's really uncomfortable for me. And as an autistic woman, there are times where I will engage in it and it's exhausting to me afterwards.
Where's the discomfort coming from, though?
I think for me, I connect better around those deep connections. Those like how I was saying before, like, Paula, I hear your passion for this topic and it makes me want to sit and have a coffee with you and really go deep. The kind of like, I don't know your intentions, like, of the small talk is uncomfortable for me as an autistic woman. So for me, I tend to steer away from the tips around small talk and towards being, again, curious about what types of communication are accessible to different people within our community.
Yeah. Paula, how do we go from small talk to having a full-blown conversation that's engaging? I hear this all the time. People tell me, oh, you have the gift of gab. So obviously I chose the right career, but I mean, do you think that being a conversationalist, is that natural, or do you learn it?
I think it's partially learned. It's partially temperamental. I think I agree with Stephanie about the fact that small talk can be very enervating, but if you think of it as a way into something else, it can be productive. But I have to say there are people that don't want to have the kind of conversation that I like to have. And then I guess I don't necessarily want to pursue it beyond a certain point. Mm. Some people just don't want to talk, have an, I was going to say intense, but I think that's too intense. I mean, they don't want to have a solid conversation. That might be Dr. Johnson, the great 18th century, scholars used that term, solid conversation. Mm-hmm. And some people just don't want to have it. And I think you just have to decide, well, you know, I won't have a conversation with that person.
Right. No pressure.
Yeah.
Is there anyone that comes to mind for you, Stephanie, when you think of someone who is good at making conversation?
You know, I think that even just the terms we're using, I'm so curious about the, you know, good or better. You know, I'm such a big fan of pulling back our pathologizing or putting on a pedestal of one type of communication versus another. I will give a shout out to the neurodivergent community. And I think, you know, Paula, as I looked into your work, you have a lot of really important things to say about social media. And I think while maybe we're all on our phones a lot, I think social media also provides access to folks who may not otherwise have a voice at the table, mm-hmm. From a variety of marginalized groups, but including the autistic, maybe the non-speaking community, you name it. So I think when I steer away from the good or bad and towards the how can I hear from more voices?
Yeah, let's talk more about that. How do we make conversations more accessible? I'm speaking to you as a autistic woman, also an advocate for accessibility and disability rights.
Absolutely. So I think this is a societal issue that we need to unpack a little bit. I think there's a lot of misinformation about folks with differently wired brains, and beginning to listen to and learn from those people with lived experiences mm-hmm. is going to help us to better understand that they are capable and smart and can really engage in robust communication. It might look different than the way we're accustomed to.
Yeah. Paula, we've been focusing primarily on talking with one other person, but how about engaging in group conversation?
It's an interesting issue because, again, as a teacher, I feel it's so important when there's a group for everyone to participate and everyone to be heard. But people have different levels of wanting to be engaged as well as ability to be engaged. I do think as a teacher, we have the advantage of being able to really help every student engage. When you're in a more equal sort of situation, I get uncomfortable when somebody doesn't participate and I want them to, and we'll ask them a question or try and get the whole group to talk on one topic where everyone is engaged. And, you know, a dinner party, for example, is something I love, but I want to have six people, maybe. I talk about this in the book, six people is the ideal, because if you get beyond six, it's very hard to have a conversation as a group where everybody is talking about the same thing.
That's a good number. Six. Yeah.
Six. Less than six is okay, too. But I'm saying if you get to eight, it gets hard.
To keep track, for sure.
Yeah.
So I want to dive into the influence of technology. You touched on it briefly, Stephanie, a moment ago, but how does tech get in the way of a good conversation?
I think, you know, Paula and I may have different perspectives on this, and I think that inherently is part of robust conversation, right? And I love being able to come together with different perspectives. So for me, you know, I think, again, like thinking about what could be an accessibility aid to someone who communicates through written word,
yeah,
or who is able to put their thoughts down in an Instagram post more easily than they're able to verbalize, who is able to use the chat function in Zoom during a meeting or during a conversation or a class, but isn't feeling as ready to use their spoken words. Mm. So again, like figuring out how to not put on a pedestal the spoken word, but also, you know, of course, having your own individual boundaries around technology.
Yeah, we can have productive and engaging conversations online, right?
Absolutely. I would say that as I have an Instagram presence through my advocacy work, and in that space, I have met a community of other autistic women and adults, parents, providers of different types that support autistic kiddos. And it has helped me to feel a lot less isolated in the world as an autistic woman and a provider.
Paula, as a whole, do you think we've become more distant from each other and from strangers?
I think so. I think we're more polarized as a nation. Certainly, I also think social media has had some detrimental effects, although I agree with Stephanie. I've had I have a weekly discussion on Zoom with people from all over the world, actually, about Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. That is one of the most delightful and wonderful engagements that I have. But I do prefer face-to-face, I have to admit, although I do agree that for some people, the social media has been a boon.
Yeah, and because we had to use and rely on so much of it over the last 3+ years, we've all heard that sentiment that, we just lost our social skills during the pandemic. Is that valid, Paula? Would you say that?
Well, a lot of my students are uncomfortable. They have to relearn how to engage face to face. And I think this is something we're going to have to deal with, and hopefully we will, because I do think there's something to be said for seeing somebody in the flesh, looking in their eyes, watching their expressiveness, their whole body language, mm-hmm. And then going off with them after, you know, a conversation and having a cup of coffee, or, you know, developing a relationship that way. But I think, you know, again, everything is mixed. I don't want to be doctrinaire about it. There are many good things coming out of our technological space.
Stephanie, what would you say the pandemic taught you about connecting with other people?
Wow. What do I even choose first? But I think, you know, if it made advocating for myself more normalized, it made creating spaces for accessibility for myself a little bit easier to understand. I didn't grow up being taught how my brain worked and what I needed to communicate. And that was detrimental to my mental health. And once I was able to learn about that and to be able to advocate for that, mm-hmm. in a way that society's beginning to accept, for example, you know, sending more emails, communicating via Zoom. You know, I still like an in-person conversation from time to time.
Me too. But I love them.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be black and white, right? I think like the COVID really taught me that like there is nuance, and you can live in that gray area and also feel okay about advocating for yourself and your needs when they're different than maybe what the expectation is.
Sure. What do you think we lose out on when we don't have meaningful conversations with other people? I'll go to you first, Paula.
Oh, I think we see each other in much flatter, less humane ways when we don't engage with each other. We can tend to demonize each other. I think that's happening often in this country. When we don't talk to people with different views, we don't understand who they are as human beings, and we turn them into the other. And that is a very, very dangerous sort of thing. And it's bad for us as well as bad for the community.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, what are your thoughts? What do we lose out on?
I think that community piece you're talking about, Paula, is so important. So finding opportunities to connect with folks, to have those meaningful conversations that lead to positive shifts, even if they're small, right? Like being able to have this conversation right now where maybe someone is learning about neurodiversity for the very first time because we're having this robust conversation. I see the way that that is something that if we don't have these conversations, we're missing out on opportunities to make social change.
And we're back now with more Reset. I'm your host, Sasha Ann Simons. We're continuing our discussion on the art of having conversation. Now, earlier, we talked about ways that we can engage in better conversations and master things like small talk and connecting with new people. Now we'll turn to conversations that you might have with your partner, or your friends and family members. Those tough and sometimes uncomfortable conversations, from that debate during Thanksgiving to talking about finances with your spouse. It can be hard to just sit down and talk. So we will explore ways to make those conversations easier and less stressful. We're still here with Paula Morantz-Cohen, who's the author of Talking Cure, an essay on the civilizing power of conversation. And now I want to introduce another voice to the conversation. Danielle Portis is a licensed clinical professional counselor at Rose Gold Crowns. Welcome, Danielle.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, there are some topics that we know right off the bat, they can just be off limits, you know, for people to talk about. I'm talking about things that I mentioned, like religion and politics, sometimes even money. Mm-hmm. Has it always been that way, that those conversations, those topics just make us so tense before we even begin?
I think so. I don't know a time where it wasn't tense. But I will say what makes it so tense is because those are things that people protect, and it brings them to the conversation with defense and having to protect how they feel about the people they support in politics or what they believe in as far as religion or how they manage or don't manage their money. They're coming to conversations already feeling like they have to protect something.
Yeah.
And so
money can be a sensitive issue.
Exactly. And so navigating that conversation defensively already starts the communication at a deficit.
Anything to add, Paula? How did we get here?
Yeah, I think certain topics have always been touchy, and certain cultures, certain things are more touchy than others. I know that in America, I think money is maybe more often spoken about than in Europe, mm-hmm. for example, where maybe sex is spoken about more in Europe than in America. I'm not sure, it's changed over time. But I think what was just said, that there's a defensiveness, people feel threatened sometimes that they will look bad or will, and that is part of what keeps these things closed, and they're worried about how they will appear or how they'll be judged in those contexts.
You know, on the same note of politics, we got to mention that former President Donald Trump being indicted yesterday in connection with efforts to overturn the 2020 election. I mean, how do you even begin to navigate having discussions about things like that, especially when people may not be in alignment with your political views?
I'll answer that. I think when you when I deal with somebody else, I always assume that I just don't know what they may think. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the problems is often people assume that other people think like them, or that they are horrible because they don't think like you and therefore are to be, you know, either shunned or debated. And I think both of those attitudes are just destructive, because no matter what the position, there's always some kernel of something that you'll be able to, if not agree with, relate to in some way.
Yeah.
And taking that attitude of, I want to understand where you're coming from on this, or what you think about this, genuinely asking what the other person thinks, as opposed to saying something like, isn't this horrible, or, you know, making the judgment right away, which then puts the other person on the defensive.
Kind of reminds me of what we were talking about earlier, leading with that curiosity first.
Exactly.
That question.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to say. That stands out to me the most, curiosity, because you don't know how people think, you don't know how people feel, and again, you don't know what they're protecting and how much they have put into deciding what they believe in and what they are. You know, when you think about like politics and what goes into it, those people have a following that they've built over time. And so they're supporting something bigger than the person or the politician.
Yeah.
And you really have to lead those conversations with curiosity. You don't know what the other person thinks. So maybe even saying, tell me what you think about so-and-so, or tell me how you feel about something that just happened recently. Then you can see, are you talking to an ally, or are you talking to somebody that you're curious about their perspective, and you may even want to change yours after you hear what they have to say? Or are you talking to somebody that you want to share why you feel the way you feel? But if you lead with your views, you may not ever get to that part.
Yeah, you're already like
clash
at heads. Yeah, exactly. What do you think of the sentiment that people are too sensitive these days, and we just can't say anything anymore? How do you think you could maybe turn that around and make it just a productive conversation? I think it's kind of a little bit of what you just described.
Yeah, I think people are more sensitive these days, but I think, I'll take that back. I don't think people are more sensitive these days. I think that people are more comfortable expressing their emotions these days, and they've always been sensitive. And so now people are more comfortable with saying, that hurt me. I don't want to talk about that. Like, boundaries is a buzzword now. Mental health is big now and more accepted across cultures. And so people are more comfortable advocating for themselves and saying what conversations they don't want to participate in.
Yeah, people are more, you know, open about the fact that they go to therapy. Correct. They're telling people. People are posting about it. That was not happening once upon a time. What are your thoughts there, Paula?
I do think, I love what was just said, that people are not more sensitive, but more open about their sensitivity.
Yes.
And being able to tap into that and understand that and say, I understand your feeling about that. And I feel sensitive too. I mean, or I want to share how I feel. I think a mutual vulnerability is one of the things that makes for people to connect. So if you can expose yourself to some extent, I think other people will be more willing to share with you. It's a hard thing to do, and you have to do it authentically and not, you know, just perform it. And again, not everybody can do it, but I think if you can do it and practice it, you'll connect better with other people.
When you see couples, Danielle, for a therapy session, I mean, what do you hear from them as common points of contention? Because I'm sure you hear some of the same things.
Yes.
Over and over.
I hear people hearing what they wanted to hear and not
what was
said. So
not listening?
Mm-hmm.
Not listening.
Or something, people responded to how something made them feel and not what they said. So, again, that defense. Now you have to. Now you are in a conversation where you feel like you have to protect yourself from your partner instead of understanding and being progressive with your partner, because this is somebody that you're with. I hear a lot of people not taking into consideration why they think that way. Maybe they were raised differently or are used to different dynamics, especially if they are co-parenting with other people outside of the relationship.
Yeah, that's a big one.
That takes into now, as I'm speaking to you as your partner, I am speaking with consideration for somebody else that's not in the room. And that is something that, whether it's another partner, a parent, or something, our thoughts are coming from somewhere.
Now, before we wrap, I'm curious from both of you, how do we become more open to having tough conversations? Leave us with that, because I know that there may be folks listening right now who call themselves conflict avoidant. You first, Paula.
I guess just assuming the other person has good intentions and being curious. I mean, that's a term we've used again and again, being curious about why they think the way they think and not judging, prejudging. And that is really central to a good conversation.
And Danielle, you were walking us through some of the things that you deal with every day with couples and in couples therapy. At the same time, piggybacking off of what Paula just said, I mean, we got to learn to pick and choose our battles, don't we?
Yes.
How many times do you say that?
All the time. I would add to what Paula just said, that people need to be more comfortable with being flawed. And one thing she said earlier was we have to have a mutual vulnerability present in order to have good communication. And so we have to leave perfection out of it. If you don't know something, if you aren't amazingly intelligent in an area, it's okay. Ask questions. Be okay with not knowing everything and take the pressure off of yourself. I think a lot of anxiety and defense comes into conversations that's unnecessary.
We'll leave it there. We've been talking with Danielle Portis, who's a licensed clinical professional counselor at Rose Gold Crowns, and Paula Marantz-Cohen, who's the author of Talking Cure, an essay on the civilizing power of conversation. Thank you both so much. This episode of Reset was produced by Micah Yason and Claire Hyman. It was edited by Andrew Merriweather and Dan Tucker. Now, if you love thoughtful conversations, then you really should make sure that you're subscribed to the Reset podcast. We share episodes every morning and afternoon, anywhere that you listen to podcasts. That'll do it for today. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll talk to you tomorrow.